and open a House Committee on Human Services on Wednesday, May 25th, 2011. And I'm opening up a work session on Senate Bill 746A and Senate Bill 748A. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 746A requires members of the Legislative Sensitive Review Committee to develop findings and conclusions and make recommendations to the Director of the Department of Human Services regarding policies and practices. It requires disclosure of the report upon request by any member of the Legislative Assembly unless otherwise exempted from the disclosure and declares an emergency on fact upon passage. We have received both no revenue and no fiscal impact statements on this measure. Senate Bill 748 A requires persons conducting child abuse investigations or making protective order determinations to have a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree from an accredited institution of higher learning. Exempts current Department of Human Services employees and law enforcement officials. Again, we've received a no revenue and no fiscal statement on this measure.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for attending this morning. And Representative Schaffler, I understand you're supposed to be chairing a meeting next door,
ma'am.
So we'll take your testimony first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mike Schaffler, State Representative, House District 48, Happy Valley, Outer Southeast Portland. And I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to testify, and I apologize for not being at the public hearing for these bills. In 2005, my close colleague, mentor, and friend here appointed me to the Sensitive Review Committee. Since then, we've done a whole lot of work to make the termination of parental rights and foster care system better for some of the most vulnerable members of our community, and I believe these two bills do that. Add to that. One, it would make the findings of the Sensitive Review Committee would be responsibility of the members, the legislative members, rather than the department. That's Senate Bill 746A. And the other one requires folks...
And why don't you give us the number, please?
Senate Bill 746A. That's
okay, got that one.
And then the second one, Senate Bill 748A, requires persons conducting child abuse investigations to have a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree. They're already doing this, I understand. And I do apologize. Representative Krieger here knows a lot more about this than I do, but it has been a great opportunity for me to learn about this part of the law and an opportunity to, once again, help make the world better for some of the most vulnerable members of our community. And I do I apologize. I'm chairing Business and Labor right next door, and forgive me, I'm not. I'm Representative Kenner is chairing today, but we have some very important bills that I want to get back to.
Great. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank
Any
you.
Quick questions, Representative Schaffler? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. You kind of read that one.
Yeah, I did. Okay. Thank you, Representative, for attending today.
Okay. For the record, Wayne Krieger, State Representative, District 1, Chair. I appreciate you taking time to hear these bills. They kind of come out of a work group and the Sensitive Review Committee findings that we've done over the years. And specific to 746A, the first sensitive review that I took part in was out of Lincoln City. And some of the things that we found there when we did that, not only were the legislators kind of alarmed, but it was also Dr. Goldberg was very alarmed of what we found. And I think the information was not really put into a findings or conclusions type report that the department would have, and that they can put that then into maybe modifying practices or policies of the department. And this bill really does that. A lot of this stuff becomes lost and forgotten. I believe that both the DHS as an agency and the families that they serve would benefit from Senate Bill 746. Specifically to 748, education and the background of the people that do all these investigations was one of the things, again, identified by the work group. And also in the Sensitive Review, it was discussed the importance that these people, when you are involved in taking the children out of a home to protect them, we want to do that. We want to make sure they're taken out for the right reason. There's no vindictiveness there, that these people are very professional in what they do. And at the time I was thinking, because they deal with people's rights, you know, I don't know of anything, maybe other than a capital crime, that would affect me more than having my children or grandchildren taken away. It's a lifetime effect, not only on the parents and the grandparents who have no control. We require police officers, besides the degrees that most of them have, to go to 16 weeks of extreme intense training at BBST. And we continue to update that training and add to that training to make sure when they're out here working with the public that they do so very carefully. One of the things I haven't had much of a discussion about with anybody, and that is the mental health issues that a lot of these families have, the parents, sometimes the kids, and I don't know if they're being trained properly to understand how that's affecting the situation. But I think having an educational degree, as Representative Schaffler said, I think they're working towards that end now, but I think it would be a great improvement to the process for both the families and the agency.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Yes, Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick, Representative Krieger. The degree I see is kind of an important piece, but I mean, another piece is, if we send somebody who's never had children or never actually raised their own family, they don't understand the dynamics either. And I'm just wondering if that might be a little more important piece than the educational piece. I mean, they need to understand the mental aspects, but there's a lot of people who come out and are being fed a lot of stuff and they don't know how to use it practically for the common sense factor.
Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam and Representative Widener, that discussion regarding having someone just get out of school, 23, 24, maybe don't have children, I'm not aware of how many of those people start out alone or how much time they have with DHS before they pretty much are starting to handle cases. But there is and has been expressed a concern about people that have never experienced having children or control of children or that type of thing, whether that isn't something that would be extremely beneficial to them. I don't know if you can exclude somebody from employment simply because they don't have kids. I'd hate to see that at the same time. But definitely having a background of understanding families and the things that happen in families that sometimes the mom or dad don't even have control over, I think would be beneficial, and I hope that DHS would train their people in a manner. And that's why, besides the education, one of the other things we found and going through these reports and sensory review and the work group is ongoing education. As things change and science changes, we know more about this issue, that the continuing education of their caseworkers and their staff people would be a benefit not only to them and the agency, but the people that they serve.
If I may follow up. So I think one of the other problems we could run into is the school that they came from and the professor that's teaching them, because you get people that are at different levels where one person says, oh my goodness, they're smoking in the house. Well, that's damaging a kid. And so they'll want to pull the kid out for that, where another person, hey, this is the way things are structured, and understands that's not the serious part with the child. So you get this extreme nanny state versus in the person who's very conservative. He didn't push the kid off the roof. He just fell off the roof and didn't tend to him the way they...
Well, co-chairs, again, and Representative Widener, the prerogative as to remove or not remove for whatever person, there are certain criteria that the department has. And I feel for the most part, we get involved, I think, in the sensitive review on a very small number of cases, but sometimes they're very tragic. And as a result of it, it's no different than the work that I did as a police officer. You are going to make mistakes. But you better recognize the mistake, admit the mistake, and then correct it. And I would hope that they would start going in that direction more than they have in the past.
He's on 748.
Yes, sir.
Hello there. Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late, but you may have already gone over this, but I'm just curious, what numbers of folks are we talking about? How many folks do not have that education degree right presently? Who are making those decisions? Do you have a sense of
that? Co-chairs and Representative Fredericks, I don't have those numbers. I think it has come up a time. I know that they are getting more and more people with degrees to do that work. Being a caseworker, is not an easy job.
No.
There are cases, they've got too many cases, we don't have enough causes, we're not getting proper representation for the families. I really believe that someday there's going to be a challenge on something because we are not providing attorneys for these people. And that's both the kids and the parents. And they need the services and the objective in most cases, hopefully, and they do, reunite most of the families and get them back to being a family again. And if it's a drug problem, mental health, or whatever it is, that needs to be the emphasis of it.
Senator Ferriola, would you like to join Representative Cruz up here?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would.
Krieger. I saw Cruz on that.
Well, the reason, Co-Chair, that you made the mistake, we both have a lot of forehead.
Oh, yeah. That's it. That's it. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. State Senator Ted Ferrioli. Let me first thank both the co-chairs for offering the time to hear these bills. I think they're extremely important. Over the past 15 years as a state senator, I don't think I've had any other issue that's generated more traffic. Telephone calls, letters, requests for assistance from family members, members who are engaged directly with DHS and then the nuclear family, but also the extended family members who are quite mystified sometimes about what is happening in their family. And because of our focus, our tight focus on the benefit of the child and requirements of confidentiality, internal to the Department of Human Services and external from the federal government, tied to various revenue sources that are used for alcohol and drug counseling and others. It's very difficult for a legislator to get any idea of whether or not the agency follows its own rules, is being responsive to the rights of people that are in the system, and whether or not the decision tree is logical. So, you know, I have brought a series of bills, only two of which should have made it to this point, that we think are trying to assist legislators in doing the job that they want to do and that they need to do, and that's to make sure that the decisions are made for the best interest of the child, but in consideration of the laws of the state of Oregon and the rights of all the citizens involved. The two bills that you have before you, Senate Bill 746 and Senate Bill 748, let me just briefly touch on what those bills do and the practical nature of why we're asking for this change. In the case of 746, it simply requires the Sensitive Review Committee itself to develop findings and conclusions. And the reason that we have this bill is that in our Sensitive Review Committee, which, by the way, we cannot discuss with members of the committee, we can talk about procedures. We got into a little bit of a wrangle with the Department of Human Services about who it is that's authoring the report. And it's not an adversarial position, it's just a difference of opinion. The way we read our responsibility, it is that the legislators on the Sensitive Review Committee have an obligation to exercise oversight authority and conclude for themselves whether or not the agency's followed its own rules, followed the law, and done the things that we think are appropriate for the agency to do, given the fact set. And the Sensitive Review Committee is the only place that I'm aware of where members are privy to all of the information that was developed by the agencies about the case. And we are sworn to confidentiality, and the files after the review are destroyed. But at the end of the day, it's the legislature that has the obligation to make a conclusion about whether the agency's done what it should do and to make recommendations to the leadership in this building about changes that may be necessary. So we thought it was a good thing if we articulated clearly that it is the Sensitive Review Committee that develops, from the information that's presented, the findings of fact and the conclusions. So that's what this minor change in the law does. It just clarifies who it is that's supposed to be actually the author of the report. If we leave the Department of Human Services in charge of reporting on itself, we run the risk of having the idea of the sensitive review committee debased in terms of its credibility, because any time we ask an agency to report on itself, we're straining the credibility issue, and there's always the chance that the corporate culture in agencies is to circle wagons when there's a challenge, and we don't want that. We want an honest review by legislators done in confidence so that the agency can get improvement from the benefit of that third-party review. So that's why we're asking 748 or 746 to be put into statute. In 748...
I'm going to stop. Did you have a question?
I do.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Senator, thank you for coming this morning, and Representative as well. I wondered if you could just say something a little more about the Sensitive Review Committee, recognizing that the contents of your discussions are confidential, but how long has the committee been around, and when did we establish it?
I think it was 2009, Madam Chairman, to the co-chair. The idea was that the sensitive review could be called by either of the leaders of the House and Senate, or it could be called by the director of the Department of Human Human Services to deal with an issue that rises above the level of concern that most cases have, and something from which the agency needs to look at its own processes and have a discussion with legislators. Now, individual legislators can certainly confer with their own leadership or the director of the department and say, this is one that we really need to look at, because there's some concerns being raised at the community level. And I think all of you that have served any length of time have had cases that have risen well above the concerns that you hear in an individual family. CASA, court-appointed special advocates, will raise issues and bring them to legislators. Law enforcement sometimes will come forward and say, gee, somebody ought to look at this because, you know, we've got a bad feeling about what's happening here. You know, even just ordinary citizens or extended family members can say, I don't think this case is being handled the way it ought to be. And any of those things can generate traffic. And through the Sensitive Review Committee, we have a mechanism to sort of pierce the veil of secrecy around the confidentiality, which is put there for the protection of children and families. It is a valuable tool. And I don't want to make a statement that this is in any way an adversarial effort between legislators and this agency. The agency itself has recognized that it has to develop the sensitive review process, because there are times when you do really have to take up an issue. I can give you an instance, an example of what change has come, and I think I can do it without any violation of confidentiality. In some cases, agency folks make a determination which people in the family don't agree with, and that disagreement may be seen in some sense as resistance. And the agency itself has a policy of not predicating its decision on the mental attitude of the folks that are in the case. But not all of the agency folks at the branch offices understand that they don't have to have agreement from everybody in the case, and they don't have to have necessarily any decision-making based on whether or not there's agreement. That's a policy. It's just not always communicated very well. And so, you know, having the sensitive review opportunity gave us an opportunity to show that there can be a difference between the policy as stated at the front office and trained for all the way down to the field staff, that the field staff is doing something entirely opposite. And that's the benefit of the sensitive review.
I have a follow-up.
Sure, follow-up.
And, Senator, you know, my questions don't come from any feeling that there's a problem between this body and the department. In fact, I'm intrigued by what you're saying, and I apologize if my colleagues are more up to speed. I'm not aware of who's on the sensitivity committee at this point, and I assume that's public knowledge. I'd be interested in that. And then secondly, when you have sensitive material, and if you can't discuss this, I understand, is it to understand the larger issue? Because you surely aren't coming in case by case. You're doing an overall kind of assessment, I would assume.
Madam Chair, to the chairman, it is case by case, and any member of the body on either side of the aisle may serve and may be asked to serve, and it has to do more with whether or not the case originates within your district.
And it's an ad hoc committee.
It is case by case. It is for the case.
Yes.
And there is a fairly prescribed procedure. It has a specific duration. The case that we're that is currently been convened is, I think it's lasted 18 months. It's way beyond where it should be. So, but the point is, it was very complicated.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm usually loath to discuss political philosophy before 9 o'clock in the morning, but let's make a little exception here. I worry a bit about the separation of powers issue, that the role of, I guess, what's now called the legislative department versus the executive department, and what our role is in this. It's sort of amazing when a constituent complains and I call Boley or I call somebody, we get an answer that other people don't get, and that's good, and it partly relates, I think, to our general legislative function. But I wonder, and I instantly love this process that you're talking about now. I think it really properly balances our legislative oversight role with the executive role. But is there a problem tipping that balance? I mean, is there a problem with the legislature moving too much into what we should be holding the governor responsible as the head of the executive branch? And where is that line? You're both very experienced legislators.
Co-chairs and Representative Grinlick, the original statute called for the director had the authority to call it, to convene a censure review. And then we did a bill, I can't remember if it was last year, 2 years ago, 4 years ago, that allowed the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate to ask him to do it also. Or I can do it, you can do it, but specifically I think would have more weight if we saw. So we can't demand him to do it, but the statute says if he's presented with the facts and it appears to him that, hey, we do need it, then he can do it. You talk about how
he or she in this case.
Yeah, how big or how much work is put into this. One of the cases we looked at had over 3,000 pages, and some of the material was available. Of course, all the in disclosure for the attorney who represents a family, then they can give it to us, but the agency can't give it to us. Well, my wife spent 450 hours on one case, line by line, word by word, with testimony to find out what the facts were, and it was alarming because no one had done that in-depth look within the agency. And so I think that when we do find something that, and I might add that, I don't know, 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 20, I don't know what the number is of complaints I get, that we ever get to that point. Most of the time I think the agency has acted in pretty good faith. But the separation of powers, as you're saying, at some point, we have constituents to represent, and we have no way of knowing the facts if we don't have some type of a process, and this simply gives us a process to be able to do that in confidentiality.
Madam Chair, I'd like to also respond to Representative Greenlee, if that's acceptable. It is a question that needs to be in legislators' minds. I mean, we are responsible for the separation of powers issue. But in this instance, what's occurring is after the fact, and it is sharing of information, and the objective is to improve the future actions of the agency. So I can't imagine in any sensitive review case having a conclusion that would necessitate the revisitation of the case or reversal of a decision. It is to get the information that may indicate changes in the authority of the agency, the legislative powers delegated.
That's clearly in that.
Yeah. So I guess the point is, although I see it as raising the issue, I think that the way the tool is used it preserves the separation of powers, but it allows an information flow that ordinarily wouldn't be available. So I respect the question. I understand the question, and I think that it's made clear in the Sensitive Review Committee that the purpose is to improve the future of behaviors within the agency rather than to try to second-guess or involve. You know, the one thing that's really clear for members of the Sensitive Review Committee is none of us wants the job of being a caseworker.
No.
You know, that is not something that we relish because it's terribly difficult and demanding work.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. We need to move along. Any other quick questions of either of these two witnesses?
Ma'am, can I touch briefly on 748?
Absolutely.
Just briefly.
I wanted to answer
a question that was asked earlier. Because of all of the things that we've just discussed in the complexity of doing the job, we think it's necessary that people have more than a high school diploma to be a caseworker. And admittedly, we have wonderfully talented and capable high school graduates in our state, but 65 of them are actually caseworkers in the state system that do not have any training as a psychiatric social worker other than the 4 weeks of orientation they get when they join the Department of Human Services. And they are actually out making case decisions. The bill is prospective. It doesn't require anybody to be changed, you know, or to have their job description changed or to be cashiered out of the service. What it does require is that when folks are doing the investigations and are actually making the determinations about custody, that they have a degree. You know, we would hope it would be in social work, but at least have more than a high school diploma. Just because this work is so complicated and it's so demanding and the life changes are profound. There's another two bills that didn't make it this far, and with the chair's permission, I'll just mention. One was a continuing education piece. We think that CLE for attorneys and other professionals is just a wonderful idea, and I think all of you have experience with CLE in your own professions. But there is no requirement for continuing education for caseworkers, and the agency clearly agrees that it should be a feature, and they're trying to figure out how to get that done also. We just didn't get the bill this far. And I think the other one would be just a little more formalized mechanism for information sharing with legislators that would not require a convening of the Sensitive Review Committee. For instance, in every county there is an oversight committee convened by the district attorney, but typically those are so far in advance of a case that legislators probably wouldn't fit very well in that regard because no decisions have been made. And the other one is we have CASAs everywhere. That's a court-appointed special advocates, and there may be a place for some interface between legislators and CASAs so that we have a little bit more immediate feedback on how the agency is moving forward. But in the final analysis, Representative Greenlich raises the most important issue, and that is in our desire to be responsive to people in our district, we have to be cognizant that we do not want to influence or become insinuated in investigations, either criminal or ongoing investigations. That is not the proper role of the legislator. So we haven't figured out how to make that interface better. We're confident that simply moving forward on who it is that writes the report for the Sensitive Review Committee and that we have well-qualified caseworkers, particularly in the rural areas where it's hard to find degreed people that want to make themselves available for these jobs, that would be a good threshold to have. So we commend that legislation to the wisdom of the committee, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, both of you, for coming today. Is it anyone else who was... Nobody had signed up to testify.
No,
just invited testimony. Great. Thank you very much. With that, Mr. Kochar, I think I would let's see, he just has to make a motion, right?
Correct.
All right.
You will entertain a motion,
yes.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Well, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 746A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Gilliam moves Senate Bill 746A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad that we had the additional testimony today.
Yes.
And it's been very helpful to me. I didn't understand the logistics, and it's probably my fault for not doing more homework. But I'm impressed by the discussion here, and I think the need to go to, let's just call it the next level with the tools for the sensitivity, what are we calling it? The Sensitive Review Committee, I think, is very apparent. I think we've all faced the problem of constituents who have who are in crisis, and so you know, sorting that out. It's not our role to override the department, but if this will help streamline that and make those decisions a little easier or a little more informed, then I think. I would urge and I vote by the committee.
Thank you. And just for public information, I've served, I think, at least on two of these sensitive review committees, and I've been a social worker in a previous life, and as Representative Krieger especially talked about his wife, many hours that she spent on these files. The files were literally this thick. It's just an incredible process. So I also encourage the committee to vote aye on this bill. Any further discussion? All right. Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Greenwood?
Aye.
Representative Harper?
Excused.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Wagner?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Greger?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Co-Chair Tomei?
Aye. Having received the required majority votes, the motion passes. I think I would like to carry this,
good.
Colleagues.
I think that'd be good.
Okay. And so, Mr. Co-Chair?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 748A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Chair Gilliam moves Senate Bill 748A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Greenwood.
I absolutely support the concept of this, but I worry a little bit about the practical implications of it. In the budget hearings, we hear that this position is at about 50% of what it ought to be in terms of the number of people in the slot, with a hope to move it up to 80% with some additional money that's may or may not be in the budget. I wonder the extent to which the salary is too low to attract well-trained people, and whether this ultimately will have a fiscal, which it probably should have, and it probably should be okay. But I think we're moving it through on the assumption that it doesn't have a fiscal. A minimal fiscal, is that
minimal?
That makes me wonder if that's a realistic fiscal. I definitely support the bill. I think people ought to be trained for doing this job. Any of us that have observed these workers understand how complex and difficult that job is. But anyway, that's a cautionary note. I support the bill.
Thank you, Representative, especially with your experience on ways and means, you know. How difficult it is. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry I'm a little talkative today. I don't want to slow us down, but I am kind of, it's pushed my button a little bit hearing this testimony. And to Representative Greenlick's comment earlier, I am loath to load on an additional burden onto the department close to 9 a.m. this morning. But I would say raising this standard, I hope, will be a help to the department. And just as I think Representative Greenlick's point is well taken, I hope that it will attract and move us to a higher standard for the folks that are doing this. I want to be very careful here, and I think Senator Farioli was being very clear, too. Maintaining our roles does not mean a criticism of the department. I have numerous issues, so to speak, with the department. I have concerns about the size of the department and so on and so forth. I think that's our job. But I am not sitting here in judgment of the department, and one of the reasons I say that is the number 13,000. The number 13,000 is in this file of mine right here, and that's the number, maybe it's the last time it was available, in 07, over 13,000 reported cases of abuse in this state. That's 07, so maybe there's some newer numbers. That number came up again the other day when we were proclaiming this to be Foster Youth Month. Over 13,000 foster youth. We've got a tsunami of abuse. Sorting that out, substantiating that, taking into account parents and grandparents, it's all very important. But if you want to deny that we have this kind of problem in the society in Oregon, you've got your head in the sand. Would I like to hand pick the people that do this? You bet. I'd like to hand pick the people in my caucus. Or the people
I'd be happy to help you.
Or the people up here on this dais. But we can't do that in a society like this, and I think we have to have faith that there are folks working hard. I see some of them in this room in the department. I come from a faith background, so I being a PK, I'm allowed to quote John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, who said, if I were drowning, I'd rather be seen by a burglar who could swim than a bishop who couldn't. We're going to have to deal with a different group of backgrounds and values, but we're going to have the faith that people are trying to do the very best for families and for children who are the most vulnerable and being abused. So I'm going to vote aye and hope that we raise the standard and then we continue to work together, because we got a serious problem in the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, in terms of full disclosure, well, I'll let you speak first, Mr. Co-Chair.
I'm going to support this bill. I think it moves us in the right direction, but I, too, have some real reservations about the speed at which we can get there. We don't have the people trained to do this. We don't have the budget to pay the people who will certainly ask for a higher salary than what a high school diploma would require. And I am reminded of a particularly difficult case I worked on a number of years ago where the person I was up against did have an advanced degree. She had just completed her master's in archaeology and was a caseworker and was not well trained. So I don't see anything in this bill that specifies the degree. So, you know, we're entering into an arena where we might want to be careful. But I think that the direction is correct. And I am frankly more concerned about continuing education than I am the actual entry degree. But I think this gets us in that kind of direction. But we have to be cognizant of the fact that this program is woefully underfunded.
Yes.
For what we would expect of the participants.
Yes, thank you very much. Representative Wagner.
Madam Chair, this one I'm kind of torn on myself. I mean, Representative Thompson sort of hit on it a little bit, doesn't say what the degree is in. Would we want somebody with an archaeology degree as a policeman, as a lawyer, as an attorney? And we're not saying what the degree is in this. We're just saying, oh, you have a degree, so we're raising the standard of what we're going to be paying people, but they haven't been trained in what they're going to be doing. And I would be very supportive of this if we go back and actually tailor the degree to the specific field and not just automatically write out a bunch of other people, because an archaeology degree is probably, and not ever having children or dealing with children or being in a family or a large family versus somebody, a mother or somebody who's raised their kids out of the system, they're looking for a job, they're probably going to be a lot better at making those judgment calls than this person who's 25 and just got their archaeology degree. So now we're writing this other person completely out of the system. And I'm not supportive of that. And I don't I may be a no vote on this just for that one reason if we're going to move it today. Otherwise, I would like to see us go back and clean it up a little bit.
Our intent is to move it today, Representative. So I can understand your position. In terms of full disclosure, I was an LCSW, and I did work in the agency early in my career. And I'd been trying for many years since I'd been in the legislature to require that caseworkers do have an LCSW, licensed clinical social worker. And because of the huge expense that would be entailed, and we've always been looking for money, that it was never even seriously considered. So I'm glad at least to see that we're making some progress with this bill, and perhaps we can move further in the future. Representative Greenlee?
I'd like to speak in defense of archaeology degrees. It seems to me being able to dig into the past might be a very useful function for these social
good point.
Workers.
Good point. With that, I think...
The point that should be made there is a sensitive case involving a child's adoption is being fought over by an archaeologist and a botanist. That's not where you want to be.
Right. And perhaps in the future we can move further along on this issue, and certainly continuing education I think would be an important issue for us. And if we're going to ask the agency to do that, we need to fund that. So we'll be looking at that in the next session. So do we have a motion, right? So any further discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative Weiner?
No.
Representative Parrish?
Yes.
Representative Parker?
Oh, excuse.
Representative Greenlee?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Frederick?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Co-Chair Tomei?
Aye. Having received the required votes, this bill passes, and I will carry it.
Wonderful.
Okay, we will move on and open up a work session on Senate Bill 238. Jennifer.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 238A requires the Oregon Health Authority to review rules relating to patient data and information provided to OHA by mental health and addiction treatment providers and determine if excessive requirements and redundancies can be eliminated and the process streamlined. Requires OHA to adopt standardized forms, requires the department to appoint a work group to advise them in the review and development of the rules and forms. It defines the membership of the work groups. It requires the department to adopt or amend rules or forms no later than January 1st, 2012. It requires the department to report to the Legislative Assembly on the effectiveness of rules adopted or amended. Declares emergency effective on passage. And we have received no revenue, no fiscal impact statements on the measure.
And if you recall, committee, we heard testimony on this bill on the 16th of May. So my intent is to pass this bill today. Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 238A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Gilliam moves House Bill or Senate Bill 238A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Greenlee.
Yes, thank you. Just I'll support this, but with a cautionary note again. We have had trouble getting standardized and useful data out of the substance abuse field, and one of the pieces of the proposed commission, the new arrangement, really does talk about the ability to develop proper data sets so we can find out what the heck's going on in this field. So I hope this is in aid of that rather than working against that. And streamlining will make it easier for agencies to produce the data, I think, and therefore we might get more valid data out of it. But
and
we
I
need
think
this
that
data badly.
Fair. Yes. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I'll also support this, and my caution, I guess, is I look at a lot of these bills, and they wind up in reports in my inbox from the last session that we've probably not done near what we should have done with work groups that came out of previous sessions when We just get these bound reports or email reports that do nothing.
Fit nicely on the shelf.
That fit nicely on your shelf. Take a little shelf space. So I hope that, you know, I just want on the record that if we say yes to this, that we'll take the recommendations and then actually come back and do something with them, because I don't see us doing a lot of that with ones that came here before I got here. So if they actually aren't going to do anything, then I don't want to do them, but I think the mental health issues are hugely important. So we'll do this and then hopefully hold people accountable that we actually use the information to affect change in the law. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any further issues? All right. Thank you. So would you please call the roll?
Instead of doing something.
That's right. I get tired of that.
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Excused?
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Carter?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Tumay? Aye. Having received the required majority, Senate Bill 238A passes. And who would like to be the carrier?
I'll take it.
Great. Representative Greenlight will carry. Thank you. With that, we will close the public work session on Senate Bill 238A and open up an informational hearing on Clackamas County Multidisciplinary Team Vulnerable Adult Abuse Protocol.
Yes, and I think our guy has stepped out of the room.
Oh, really? Anybody want to talk about this?
Yeah, and I think he'll come back. Madam Chair, if I might.
Sure.
I think they just dashed out to get, here he is. And this was a report that was given to the DHS Adult Protective Services team, of which I sit on, and missed. And it was recommended that we give the report again to the whole committee, so I get to hear it for the first time.
Great.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is John Wentworth. I'm a deputy district attorney in Clackamas County. My role is to chair the MDT, the Vulnerable Adult MDT, in Clackamas County, and which was created in most part due to House Bill 2442. And I believe the portion of the testimony that I'm to give relates to what I, as the chairperson was saying, gave to the Adult Safety and Protection Work Group about how that law works when the rubber meets the road. We put together the MDT, and what kind of gaps did we fit?
And we're going to ask you to use words instead of letters.
I'm sorry, thank
That's
you.
That's okay.
Multidisciplinary team.
Thank you.
How does the House bill really go into effect? What works as a result of that? What doesn't work as well as we thought it would? And that sorts of those sorts of things. One of the things that has come out of this that I am most happy about is that the communication between Adult Protective Services and the other social service agencies and law enforcement has dramatically improved. To see these two groups in the same room at the same time discussing some of the same people that they didn't realize they had in common, that they were all aware of, is very encouraging. One of the things that we've tried to do is change the mindset. We recognize that social services need to report more to law enforcement. What I have seen, and I'm not being critical of APS in Clackamas County or law enforcement in Clackamas County, I think we're a representative sample of what happens statewide. But to hear adult protective service workers ask, well, is this a case that law enforcement would be interested in, when it seems clear to those of us in law enforcement that it would be, was kind of concerning. When I sat down with some of the adult protective service workers early on and discuss the kinds of cases that we would see, one of the workers said, well, we try to send you the good cases. And I said, well, what does that mean to you? Because as a prosecutor, that means a case that I can prosecute, that I can go forward and end up with a conviction down the road. For them, it was, the response was, well, you know, if, you know, tens of thousands of dollars are taken, that's a case that we would send to you. And I said, well, you know, I'm prosecuting a case right now where a woman stole a necklace from a patient that she was caring for. And the necklace was worth $140. But that's a crime. That's a felony in the state of Oregon. And so we had to change the mindset so they would understand it isn't just the big cases we're interested in. We want to stop crime against vulnerable victims on the whole. And that's a change in mindset for Adult Protective Services. By the same token, we learned that law enforcement would get cases of crime and not necessarily report that to Adult Protective Services. So we're having that same battle back and forth, and that has dramatically improved because of House Bill 2442. So I'm very excited about that. I'm not advancing here. Here we go. There's now an enhanced feeling of needing to work together in investigations to get law enforcement involved at the front end of investigations that Adult Protective Services engages in. One of the things that we've tried to do to change that mindset is to get Adult Protective Services to work more closely or take advice from Child Protective Services, because they're very used to this. One of the things that I've discovered is that the area of protection of vulnerable adults is, in my opinion, where child abuse protection was about 20 to 25 years ago. And that's kind of shocking. I mean, we're just now forming multidisciplinary teams throughout the state to protect vulnerable adults. That was done in child abuse long ago, and I'm going to show you some other areas where that's true as well. So one of the things I did was I asked a child welfare advocate to come in and speak to the Adult Protective Services to talk about how they work with law enforcement. At what point do they get law enforcement involved? What does that look like? How do they assist each other in the investigations? Because this is something that they have not been used to, they being the Adult Protective Services, in all this time. And to get the prosecutor who's going to be handling the case involved at the front end. The more information we have, more quickly, the better off the prosecution will be. One of the areas that we found were kind of troubling was that law enforcement would get a report from Adult Protective Services and they would read, for example, RP, which in Adult Protective Services means reported perpetrator. But in law enforcement jargon, that RP means reporting party. And so we're not speaking the same language, and that became very frustrating to law enforcement. They would get a report from Adult Protective Services that would list 26 witnesses, for example. And they have a key which says, here are the names of the 26 people. And then throughout the rest of the report, we'd refer to them as W13, W21. So my rule was, if I have to have a key to understand your report, you're not communicating very well. And this is one of the areas that the work group that Chair Gilliam is talking about is working on improving. Now, to talk about creating our protocol in Clackamas County, we had two templates. We had House Bill 2442, and we had the child abuse protocol that had already been created for our county. And we sat down and we kind of married the two to the best we could to make sure that we were covering all the bases that we needed to cover. One of the things that we noticed from the House bill, though, is that we wanted to be more inclusive in our county than the House bill even requires. So, for example, the House bill anticipates or mentions that those who are considered protected persons are people who, and I have the language here, people with physical or mental disabilities, for example, who are eligible for SSI or general assistance. And we thought, well, why does it have to be someone who's eligible for those services? Can't we just protect people who are vulnerable because they're vulnerable? So we wanted to be more inclusive than the House bill even required. But as we got into the process, one of the things that we noticed, and I've addressed this with the work group, was that there are many, many agencies that I can't even begin to identify for you, except that they're on page 4 of the protocol, which I hope you have a copy of, that serve many different populations of vulnerable adults. And when we sat down to identify which agencies would be, how they'd be enumerated or listed in our protocol, there was disagreement within the agencies themselves about what they were called. And we literally sat down with the dry erase board, and what I'm talking about is even the workers within their own agencies couldn't agree with what the title of their agency was. And I realized, you know, if you're having that kind of identity crisis in putting together this protocol, you don't know what your true mission is. And if you can't identify the mission, then we're missing the mark probably in some regards. And so, you know, we'd have these discussions about, well, what kinds of cases does your agency actually handle? And some of the workers would say, well, I investigate these kinds of cases, and the supervisors say, no, we don't do that. That's for this other agency. So there was an identity crisis within the agency themselves. And I'm not just talking about DHS. I'm talking about all the other social service agencies as well. And then not understanding what the other agencies do. What vulnerable adult populations do they serve, and to what extent? How do they serve those vulnerable adults? This is a wide, wide area of disagreement and concern for me. Because if you don't know you have a resource, the resource doesn't really exist because you can't take advantage of it. And I've stalled again. There we go. Another area that we found concerning was in the area of mandatory reporting. And on page 12 of the protocol, you would see that, and this is essentially an internal, it's a public document, but it's essentially internal. In other words, if I'm a law enforcement officer and I want to be able to know who to call for certain issues, here are the list of phone numbers that I would have. There are essentially three phone numbers within our county to call, depending on who your vulnerable adult is. There's even four. There's actually, you know, adults with developmental disabilities has two different phone numbers that you can call. If you add child abuse to that, that's another number to call. And one of the frustrations that I've spoken to people in the public with, people with disabilities, is there's not just one number. You know, we don't know who to call. And so we had to work into our agreement, if someone calls up Adult Protective Services and their issue is really more appropriate for a different agency, that Adult Protective Services will then forward that phone call on to the right agency. But there shouldn't be, we believe, five different phone numbers that a person has to call, potentially, to get to the place that they need to be. Ideally, we would have one centralized number, perhaps even statewide, that a professional who's required to make a mandatory report can call, for example, or someone who just thinks they see abuse going on within their neighborhood. They can make that call with far less difficulty than having to rely on numbers that are more difficult to get.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Greenwick.
I believe I remember we were taught as mandatory reporters that we can call law enforcement anytime.
You can.
And that certainly simplifies the issue of who to call. Now, would law enforcement know what to do in this case?
Well, that's part of the problem. For example, we are wrestling within our own agency with regarding jurisdiction. So in my county, the issue will be you can call 911. That's probably the easiest way to go. But if you were to call your individual agency, that could mean, well, does the municipal police agency investigate, or is it a sheriff's office case? Depends on the kind of abuse that we're talking about. And where that really gets to be confusing is in financial exploitation cases, where your victim lives in one location, the bank is in another location, which is where the caregiver is taking them to take the money. And if you report to law enforcement, eventually it'll get to the right place.
That's the question I was asking.
But even within law enforcement, being able to identify the right agency can be difficult.
So I'm not sure that you can answer this, because I think my mind is going where yours is, Representative. But when we're reporting a child abuse, and we would call 911, so they somehow sort that out, where that report should go. Is that not as feasible with the reporting of these populations?
Well, if I were to make a call to 911, I will get a dispatcher who will contact someone in law enforcement.
Right.
Law enforcement will break out the protocol and try to figure out which agency is probably the most appropriate agency. Each way down the road, I worry as a prosecutor about the trail of being able to identify. It's like playing a telephone game. The more people who are involved,
right,
the more difficult it is to get to where you really need to be. If you had someone who was centralized who would know when that call comes in, I can send it to the right place. I think much of the confusion that currently occurs could be simplified.
How do we get to that point?
I don't have the solution for that.
All right.
I just offer it as a concern that I have heard from from others who are in the disabled community,
right,
who say, you know, this is kind of hard on us.
Yes.
You know, and what complicates things is you may have a person who is an elder and they have a disability, and maybe you need more than one agency involved. And that can be even difficult for law enforcement to sort out, to be honest.
And after just hearing recently about the agency, the ombudsman, the long-term care ombudsman,
oh, yeah,
hearing about all the people in long-term care who never get a visitor, et cetera, and we know about the abuse that will hit the headlines, but we know that a lot of this is going on that's never reported, and so that is certainly an issue then. To whom is that reported and who is going to respond to that? So say there is a report. Maybe we need to have a further hearing later on from DHS. So I guess I'd like to know what happens if someone does report this, goes to the police, and the police try to refer that somewhere else. How does either DHS or some of these other agencies, Adult Protective Services, oh golly, Clackamas County Health, Housing and Human Services, and people with mental illness, they would go to the County Health, Housing and Human Services. There must be some way that this can be corrected. So maybe that would be for a future meeting that we'll have a hearing about how that's handled and how we can simplify this process, and I think that's where you're leading.
It is.
Thank you.
There we go. One of the things that I offer that is confusing for professionals who are required to mandatorily report is that there are 6 different standards for when you have to mandatorily report. The most inclusive one, or the most bright line area, I believe, is child abuse. If I, as an attorney, am working in my yard and I see child abuse occur in my neighborhood, across the street at my neighbor's house, it doesn't matter whether I'm working that day, it's a Saturday, I have other things to do, I am required by law to make a report to law enforcement or to DHS. However, for example, when it comes to elder abuse, I'm required to make a report if I'm working in my official capacity.
Really?
So even if I see elder abuse occur across the street, I'm not required to report that. No, I will. Right? That's the moral, that's the right thing to do. But I offer that because from a professional standpoint and from a community protection standpoint, I think it would be better to have one rule across the board for those who are vulnerable, whether they're children or elders or people with disabilities or people with developmental disabilities. So I offer that as a suggestion for an area where we could really improve our community by requiring more from our professionals who are required to report and make it simpler to understand the rule.
Sorry.
one of our concerns from the multidisciplinary team is that we're worried that many mandatory reporters are actually not even aware that they're mandatory reporters. For example, as an attorney, I have to receive a child abuse reporting credit every 3 years. It kind of keeps it in the back of your mind. You have to, because you're an attorney, you have to report child abuse. I'll bet you I could take a sample of attorneys in my area and they don't know whether they're required to report if they see elder abuse. Another area where we had a lot of debate came in the area of social service report to law enforcement. And so I offer in this area kind of where we changed or tweaked the law. And this morning, actually, as I read through this again, I think we need to tweak part of it back, and I'll tell you where that is. In the first line where it says, when a report of possible crime, and we changed that in the protocol to say crime of abuse. Now, the debate was, from a law enforcement standpoint, from the police standpoint, are you telling me that any crime that's committed against an elder has to go through this protocol? And as I read the law, the answer was yes. And so they said, so if someone steals mail in my block from all these different residents, and one of them happens to be an elder, that case goes through the MDT process. Multidisciplinary Team Protocol process. And the answer was yes, but I think really what the legislature intended was a crime of abuse. But when I went back and looked at the law, no, it actually does say crime. And so that's an area where, you know, I think we're going to tweak it back so that we're in conformance with the law, but I'm not sure that's what was intended in the law. It continues, when the report is received by the department, we've changed that to the social service agency to reflect that it's not just adult protective services. It could be any one of the social service agencies that we work with. Under the mandatory reporter law, again, we changed the department to the agency shall notify by fax. In our county, we're requiring a written notice. We want it in writing in some form so we can track that this person who made the report actually got to an agency that was required to receive it, that agency did with that report what they were supposed to do. Because in the child abuse realm, in my office, we've seen how important that can be. When later on, if you don't have that paper trail to show who knew what and when, you can have a real problem in terms of identifying failures in the system. So we've created that paper trail for our jurisdiction. And then the final line is the law enforcement agency having jurisdiction within the county where the report is made. So that's an issue. That was how we changed those.
So it's not where the crime happened. It's where the report was made. So if I live in Clackamas County and I see something in Multnomah County, I reported in Clackamas County, so that's where that Clackamas County agency would have jurisdiction?
No, they would have the requirement to forward that on to Multnomah County if that's where the crime occurred. So it takes the burden off the reporting party, right? Because you may not know where the actual jurisdiction lies. Mm-hmm. You've done your job by making your report to law enforcement.
Okay.
It then puts the onus on law enforcement to identify the correct jurisdiction, which I think is the way it should be.
Okay.
But what if you know it happened in another county? What happens then? And to tell you, we're wrestling with that right now. Whose onus? The law currently says that the law enforcement agency receiving the report is the one who's required to report it to the other agency. Law enforcement wants to put it back on DHS to say, well, you guys are the ones who are kind of conducting this level of the investigation, and we're wrestling with that right now. It's going to come out the way the law is written, I think, because I think that's best. But I just offer that as something that we're talking about. And then I've already spoken about the phone call versus fax versus email. What form should that take? You know, we're basically adopting the child abuse reporting form because it's already been done. It seems to work, and we're going to continue that as it is.
A lot better.
One of the issues that I've seen just on working with the Adult Safety and Protection Work Group and have noticed through creation of the MDT protocol is that training is sorely needed by especially law enforcement, by prosecutors in this area. We've had one statewide training in the last 7 years for abuse against vulnerable adults, and that has exclusively focused on financial exploitation, which is a big area and very difficult to understand, as I'm coming to learn. But the rate of turnover among law enforcement, and frankly within the DA's office, means that you're going to have people who are assigned to understand these cases with no training whatsoever. Now, what that's meant for me, for example, because I've been doing this for now a year in this particular area, I've prosecuted every other kind of crime. I'm put down into this area and expected to understand what the difference between a guardianship and a conservatorship is. And that's outside my area of expertise. And so I've had to learn that as I go along, and that can mean a big difference when it comes to, is this a case that I believe I can go forward with and prosecute? Police detectives are often assigned to the detective area for 2 years at a time, and then they rotate out and they go back to patrol or they get promoted into a sergeant's position. When you have that kind of turnover, you have people investigating these crimes that don't necessarily understand the nuances of dealing with vulnerable adults and the issues that can come along with that. And then I've already talked a little bit about one of the things that we're doing on our multidisciplinary team is identifying what other agencies are a part of the team and what they do. We started with my office. We've moved on to DHS, and we're going to go through each agency. So as I said before, if there's a tool there that you don't know you have, you might as well not even have it because you're not going to take advantage of it. So we need to understand those within our own system so that we can better serve the public as well. One of the things we've talked about are what are the investigative limitations, for example? What can adult protective service workers do and not do? And the same for law enforcement. There's kind of this assumption that if I work for DHS and I need to get law enforcement involved, they'll take care of it. They have all the tools they need. Well, you know, we have areas that we have to hold true to, too. Probable cause standards, for example, and limits on search warrants. And we can't do everything that maybe it would be nice to be able to do. But that can cause frustration if you think someone isn't doing their job when, in fact, they're actually toeing the line on what the law is. We've done training on what is a crime. I'm shocked to hear adult protective service workers say, I don't know whether that's a crime or not. And I've encouraged them to call me and ask. I'll tell you whether it sounds like one to me. What's the process? What exactly is grand jury? You know, they're surprised to learn it's actually smaller than a regular jury in many cases. Or what's an arraignment? What can happen to this person down the road? So we get a conviction, then what? What does that mean? Those areas are nuanced for people who don't work within the system, and they need to be trained in that area.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. When you say training, John, who are you training? Remind me.
Well, right now we're training within our own multidisciplinary team to get people up on board. And then the House bill contemplates, as I read it, training others in the community in the same area. But we're trying to get our own house in order and then move on to training others.
Thank you.
And then, as I said before, law enforcement and prosecutors need to learn more about vulnerable adults as well. We know generally the term dementia, but what does that mean exactly? What is mental incapacitation? What are the common defenses in cases like this? How to present complicated cases? You'd be amazed at how complicated some of these financial exploitation cases can be, because there are so many different areas where someone is taking money and the methods by which they're doing that. So these can be very difficult and challenging to learn about. We of course have the same resource issues. There's a greater expectation that we're doing more with less. I can tell you one of the benefits of having the better communication is that we're getting more cases. And what do I mean by that? It was shocking to me that in my office last year, we prosecuted 20 cases against vulnerable adults. Now, Clackamas County has over 300,000 people, and I don't believe there are only 20 cases of abuse, financial and physical, going on. I think it's far greater than that. And I've gotten a better sense of that. As we've improved communication within our county, we're getting a lot more cases coming in. And I think there are more to come. So that's my concern. And obviously, as we have a greater aging population and you have greater budget cuts and we're trying to be physically responsible, it almost can create the perfect storm. And so that's just, it's out there and something that we have to be cognizant of and deal with. So in conclusion, some of the legislative ideas I have, make mandatory reporting laws consistent, creating a centralized reporting system. One of the things I'm surprised at is if you commit a crime against a child, that crime cannot be expunged. But if you commit a crime against a vulnerable adult, it can be. I think that should be changed. Because when I'm a care facility and I'm looking at the criminal history of the people I want to hire to care for vulnerable people, I want to make sure that my liability is not to be called into question. If I'm a family member and I want to put my family member in a care facility, I want to make sure that there isn't anyone there who has a criminal history who might harm them. And so that's an area that I think we can improve on. And then the last one...
Just a second. I think that Representative Parrish has a question.
I do. You've got the no expunction of crimes for against vulnerable adults and just said you wouldn't want someone who had that background serving your grandma. We had a bill, though, on the House floor this session that passed off the House floor that would have changed the value of property crime against and freed up somebody within a certain range. I voted no for it because for the same reason you just said, but that actually then said, well, if you've done property crime under $10,000, we're going to free you up to actually go work with grandma. Is that contrary to what you just said that you...
It would be contrary to what I just said.
Okay, I want to get that on the record because I was a no vote on that. I didn't think that's not a... I want to help people, put people back to work who come out of the criminal justice system, but that's probably not where I want to put them back to work, and yet we just... That moved off the House floor, and I don't know where it is on the Senate side going over there, but hopefully you will. I just want to get that on the record.
I appreciate that.
That concerns me, contrary to what you're putting up here as legislative ideas.
Yeah. And then finally, right now, currently, it could be potentially a misdemeanor to actually assault a vulnerable victim. If you're caring for that person, it could be prosecuted as a criminal mistreatment, which is in the first degree, which is a felony. But it's not hard to contemplate a case where you're not necessarily providing care for the person, but you take advantage of their vulnerability and actually commit an assault. It's still just a misdemeanor. That's a concern for me. It's a crime if you assault a child under the age, a felony crime if you assault a child under the age of 10, but not necessarily true for assaulting a vulnerable adult.
Is there a definition for vulnerable adult in state law?
No. We've created that within our protocol just by subsuming elder, person with a physical disability, mental disability, within our definition. So there's vulnerable adult is not a term of art. It's a term that we've been using just within our county.
That there isn't in state law. So
no.
Maybe all of these are issues that the committee can work on for the 2012 legislative session. We can work on these and come up with some ideas.
I agree.
Any questions, committee? Because I'm getting up to that age where I'm included in the elderly population that is being looked at here, and I'm sorry that we lost Riverson of Greenlick, because you all will hopefully be joining me, because the other option is not one that you're going to be looking forward to.
Madam Chair, are you declaring a potential conflict of interest here?
No, I'm declaring my extreme interest in this issue. And after hearing from, as I said before, the long-term care ombudsman, and realizing this issue throughout the state is a very serious one, I would hope that our committee can work on these issues, and I really appreciate you bringing this forward, and I'm so pleased that you're on this committee, and so you can bring more information for us, because we've worked for years protecting children, and I think what we've done is neglect the vulnerable seniors in our community, and I think it's time that we start working on that. So I know people from DHS are here, and I appreciate you coming, and we'll be working with law enforcement and DHS and see if we can come up for some more improved protections for the elderly and disabled. That you brought some really important information to us that I hadn't thought of before, and that's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
I was just going to say thank you for the second chance to hear the report.
Yeah, I'm glad you're involved with that. Yes.
A question is probably too general for a direct answer, but We have all of these various peoples that we've declared to be mandatory reporters, child abuse and elder abuse. Why isn't just everybody a mandatory reporter under Oregon law? I mean, the question's come to me a couple of different times on child abuse about, you know, I saw this thing happen, but I don't know if I'm a mandatory reporter or not. No, you're a citizen of the state of Oregon. That should be good enough.
Do the right thing when no one's looking, right?
Why? What's the impediment to deciding whether...
There's not.
I mean, I know attorneys are brighter than everybody else, but I mean, other than that, you know, why don't we just take that on and declare everybody a mandatory reporter? That allows us to do the public service training on a wider basis. It's a novel idea that we should all be responsible for one another.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah.
I don't expect an answer.
I don't have one.
All right. With that, thank you very much for coming in today. With that, don't leave yet. We're closing the informational hearing on Wednesday, May 25th. Colleagues, we have a trip next week to the Oregon Youth Authority, and I think that Jennifer sent out information to us all, and we need to let her know by tomorrow, whether or not we're attending.
McLaren, is that what we're talking
about? Yes, we're going to McLaren. And I'd like you to be thinking...
is that Monday?
Wednesday. Monday is a holiday. No meeting, of course, on Monday.
Woodburn,
right. So also, if you have any other ideas that you'd like us... We have the follow-up in the future. Great. So email them to the two of us and to Jennifer.
For the record, real quick, maybe if we met with the Human Service Committee in Hawaii sometime, too, that would probably be beneficial.
Sometime in February would be a great time.
I think Paul Romaine could probably arrange that.
Right. I wouldn't mind going next week.
Next week, okay. So any ideas that we sort of have touched on maybe in this session that you'd like us to get more information on? I think we're going to have, five more committee meetings during the interim, and of course we'll be meeting again in February. So I'm really serious about perhaps coming up with some legislation for February.
Three committee days doesn't mean we won't have more than one committee meeting in this, but that's what I think they said yesterday.
Three committee days
between the end sunny die now and February.
Mm-hmm. I think that's correct.
No, we've got five sets of three committee days, I think. Four or five.
I thought it was three.
Well, we could go back to offices and check that. But anyway, we will have committee meetings, so think about issues you'd like us to get more information on.
One other thing, Madam Chair. You heard the announcement I made about the appeal to members to participate in the duffel bag drive.
Right.
And my office is filling up, so people are responding. If you've got something... bring it by my office, bring it to your caucus office, and remind our colleagues. But we're doing it between now and Friday, and it's going well.
That's great. Good.
There are several groups of people who are doing the same thing. I just delivered three duffel bags to another group for the same reason.
Good.
So
that's great. Good.
It's a great idea, and it's something that you don't think about.
Yeah.
I made a mistake years ago. I started the program of suitcases for Polk County, for CASA. I didn't think about duffel bags. Suitcases don't collapse.
Yeah.
We have a large storeroom at our local church full of suitcases, but you don't fold them up. Perhaps duffel bags are
a much better idea.
Yeah.
With that, thank you, committee, and we'll close the session on Human Services. Thank you.